The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or and or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, Pope Leo's July 4th message to America was unmistakable. Written by Francis X. Rocha, and this was written on July the 4th. President Trump is set to mark the 250th anniversary of the United States today with an elaborate celebration in Washington, D.C., featuring military flyovers and a fireworks display that organizers say will break world records. America's other global leader, however, has chosen to spend Independence Day quite differently. This morning, Pope Leo XIV visited the southern Mediterranean island of Lampedusa, where he laid flowers at the graves of migrants who had died trying to reach Europe. Leo compared them to the man who fell among the thieves in the gospel parable of the Good Samaritan. "Here you have seen not just one, but thousands of human beings fallen into the hands of robbers who have taken everything from them, beat them brutally, and walked away, leaving them half dead," the Pope said. He called on his listeners to act like the biblical benefactor. "We welcome neighbors by acting as neighbors." The first U.S.-born Pope did not mention his native land in his remarks, but given the significance of the date and his repeated criticisms of Trump's immigration policies, Leo's message to America was impossible to miss. Yesterday, the Pope released a letter marking the semi-quincentennial in which he implored the U.S. to live up to its founding ideals, particularly in its treatments of immigrants. He called on the country to safeguard human life from its beginning at conception until natural death, which must include welcoming, protecting, and assisting immigrants whose hopes, sacrifices, and contribution have formed a part of the history of this country from its very beginning. In a speech live-streamed from the Vatican, Leo also addressed the U.S. yesterday as he accepted the Liberty Medal from the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. He praised America's long history of opening its doors to successive waves of immigrants, enabling them and their children to play their part in shaping the future of the nation. Judging by his rebukes of the Trump administration, Leo plainly believes that America is failing to live up to this standard today. The Pope has made clear his opposition to Trump's immigration policies, which he condemned last year as inhuman and extremely disrespectful. In November, he backed the U.S. bishops when they denounced the government's campaign of indiscriminate mass deportation. Trump has not personally pushed back on Leo's criticisms. His remarkable attacks on the Pope earlier this year focused on the Pope's opposition to the Iran war. Instead, the administration's most prominent voice in the immigration debate with the church has been that of Vice President Vance. In a new memoir about his conversion to Catholicism, Vance dismissed some of the Vatican's statements on immigration as generic and trite platitudes. Earlier this week, the vice president told Fox News that he hoped Catholic leaders had learned from the Trump administration that it's not just about the dignity of the immigrant, it's also about the dignity of the native-born factory worker who has their wages destroyed. It's about the dignity of the child who can be sex trafficked by a cartel member when you have open borders. Leo's visit to Lampedusa seemed to confirm that defending the dignity of immigrants will continue to be a priority, just as it was for his predecessor, Pope Francis. In 2013, the recently elected Francis chose to make his first trip outside Rome to the then little-known Lampedusa after hearing about migrants who had died when their boat sank off its shores. There, Francis deplored the globalization of indifference, epitomized by migrants' plight. Francis went on to produce hundreds of pages of writings and speeches on the issue. Indeed, in one of his final acts, less than 3 months before his death last year, he sent an open letter to U.S. bishops encouraging them to oppose the Trump administration's mass deportation policies. Leo's own trip to Lampedusa, in keeping with his more restrained and traditional style, was less dramatic than Francis's. Whereas the Argentine Pope arrived at the island's main port on the Italian Coast Guard vessel, accompanied by a flotilla of fishing boats, Leo arrived by car. Francis celebrated Mass using an altar made out of a small fishing boat, but Leo opted for a conventional setting. During his visit, Leo said that the deceased migrants were victims of economic inequality, political corruption, and indifference to the common good, and by the failure of countries in the region to coordinate their immigration policies. Although Leo's principal focus on Lampedusa was defending migrants, a left-coded cause in the American political context, his messages to the U.S. highlighted two right-coded concerns, protecting religious freedom and the right to life. He described both as founding ideals grounded in a biblical understanding of the human person. Tempering criticism with commemoration, Leo ended July 4th with a diplomatic gesture after he returned to Rome by celebrating the holiday at the residence of Brian Birch, U.S. ambassador to the Holy See. This political balancing is characteristic of Leo, who has sought to reassure conservatives and progressives in the Catholic Church that he listens to both sides. The strategy reflects the importance he places on unity, as summed up in his papal motto, in illo unum, uno unum, in one, in the one, that is, Christ. We are one. In his speech yesterday, Leo made clear that he sees polarization in America and the wider world as a grave problem. Citing the U.S. motto, E Pluribus Unum, Leo told the gathering in Philadelphia, in order for a nation to flourish, it must be truly united, united not by goals bound to momentary endeavors, but by ideals that do not fade with the passing of time. As unlikely as the founders might have deemed it, one of the most ardent defenders of those ideals today is an American in the Vatican. Our next story. The overlooked reason Europe doesn't have AC. By Thomas Chatterton Williams. This summer, the transatlantic culture war has fixated on an unlikely flashpoint, air conditioning. Last weekend, I arrived in Paris at the beginning of the heat wave, or canicule, that has stifled the country and much of Europe. Temperatures in France have soared to record-breaking highs, reaching nearly 112 degrees Fahrenheit in certain parts of the country. Several young children have died in parked vehicles, and the French government reported earlier this week that dozens of people have drowned in waterways while seeking relief from the heat. Many more have been hospitalized. The World Health Organization estimates that more than 175,000 people die from heat-related causes each year across Europe. Although such tallies are imperfect, there is legitimate concern that this summer could be particularly lethal. Some commentators in the United States have taken the opportunity to lecture Europeans and perhaps even indulge in a little Schadenfreude. Just install the AC and save your grandma's life, Euro friends. The popular economics writer Noah Smith posted on X, I asked Claude about the air conditioning debate in Europe, and it really didn't pull any punches. Patrick Collison, the CEO of Stripe, wrote in a viral post, The AI model told Collison that the elaborate discourse used to justify the scarcity of AC in Europe is largely a way of processing the psychological discomfort of admitting that the American approach to summer was correct all along. Elon Musk reposted that sentiment, calling it a banger. Plenty of Americans seem scandalized that more Western Europeans don't embrace the technological miracle of AC. But the disagreement ultimately has less to do with objective criteria, such as the effects of climate change in Europe, which is warming twice as fast as the global average, than subjective questions about what constitutes an acceptable level of physical suffering and sacrifice. As someone who splits his time between the United States and France, I've seen firsthand how Americans tend to interpret discomfort as a failure of infrastructure, whereas Europeans seem much more willing to regard it as a part of life. These contrasting views have resulted in far too much air conditioning on one side and not remotely enough on the other. For many Parisians who are not psychologically vulnerable, the past week hasn't been nearly as apocalyptic as media accounts have suggested. Parisians have roiled with the heat. It certainly hasn't kept them from carrying on with their lives. Cafes and ice cream parlors are packed. The roving outdoor Fête de la Musique last Sunday, drew 500,000 revelers. Throughout the heat wave, men's fashion week parties have spilled onto the streets. My son's school, like many in France, asked parents to keep children home due to a lack of climate control. Yet everyone I know found a way to manage, and some took turns shepherding group of kids to pools and museums. Traditional French residences were designed to breathe in the summer months. Even if the architects of my building didn't anticipate global warming, their handiwork, with some minor accommodations, has made the past week bearable. When I come indoors, I mist myself with water and drink more of it than usual. Like my neighbors, I keep my windows closed behind metal shutters to block out the midday sun and open them when there is a breeze in the evening. Otherwise, to keep the air from turning stagnant, I run two purifiers. I'm sure I would feel differently if I were underneath one of the heat-absorbing zinc roofs that are common in Paris, but living on the ground level, I haven't felt the need to buy a fan yet. The temperatures have no doubt been sweltering by French standards, but not any worse than the hottest days of my childhood summers in New Jersey or my college years in Washington, D.C. I wouldn't have noticed that there was such a monumental problem had I not been plugged into X. Underneath the debate raging online is a fundamental divide about how America and Europe address discomfort. Americans have grown accustomed to treating temperature in particular and physical distress more broadly as challenges to be fixed rather than states to be endured. This is in keeping with our flattering self-conception as optimizer and pragmatist. The U.S. has spent decades engineering interior environments, offices, cars, shops, homes, in which refrigerator-like conditions are standard. For many Europeans, though, the ubiquity and frigidity of air conditioning in the U.S. play into the perception of Americans as profligate and pampered. The American big box stores that prop their doorways open on hot days and blast polar air on passersby are a symbol of perverse excess in the eyes of Europeans, who pride themselves on small but telling displays of thrift, conserving water while washing dishes, wearing extra layers rather than turning up the heat in winter, scraping plates clean at dinner. These are people who still carry within them memories of war, occupation, and stretches of extreme privation. The idea that America is the land of abundance while Europe runs on a scarcity mindset is a cliché for a reason. Neither side, strictly speaking, is responding to the weather. they seem instead to be drawing on highly different sets of values and norms around consumption, noise, pollution, even the importance of public beauty, all of which help determine whether the physical sensation of warmth is even a problem in the first place. For example, Paris has an aesthetic aversion to window units and rooftop HVAC systems, which helps explain why installing air conditioning typically requires special permission from authorities, especially in protected or historic areas. This is, after all, a town where hanging laundry to dry from your windows is illegal. Such regulations might seem draconian, but they help preserve the city's distinctive appeal. I find my own thinking about the temperature depends on where I am. In the U.S., I don't hesitate to switch on the AC, but when I'm in Paris, there is something satisfying, maybe even a little noble, about withstanding the heat without the help of climate control. One of Nietzsche's many great and provocative insights in On the Genealogy of Morals is that pain isn't objective or proportional to external conditions, but rather a matter of perspective and therefore interpretation. This truth holds for individuals and also for societies. That's why, on one side of the Atlantic, overcooled offices and subways necessitate wearing a fleece in August. On the other side, too many buildings feel like saunas. A growing divide has also emerged within Europe. In France, Marine Le Pen's National Rally Party has opportunistically seized on air conditioning, portraying it as an urgent quality of life issue that moralizing environmentalists and overreaching technocrats have ignored. As a result, the far right has polarized what should be a nuanced debate in much the same way that some American conservatives turned masking into a form of political sorting. A middle path is possible. For European leaders, it will mean adapting and installing more air conditioning, particularly in schools, public transportation, and hospitals, where the heat has wrought havoc. On Thursday, which surpassed Wednesday as France's hottest day on record, a bus driver reportedly passed out from heat stroke and crashed into a tree on the western edge of Paris. Maternity wards are overheating, hundreds of thousands of poultry have perished, and cities across the country banned alcohol sales and public consumption in an effort to ease an overburdened healthcare system. Americans may have become too intolerant of heat, but this is patently ridiculous. When I got in a taxi at the start of the heat wave, the driver left the windows open. The breeze felt like a blow dryer. We drove like that for more than 10 minutes until we got onto the highway, and he relented, switching on the AC. His preference to sweat it out, however well-meaning, had grown untenable. Our third story comes from the Ideas section of the Atlantic. The problem America refuses to address. In the age of the trillionaire, inequality remains a defining challenge. This is written by Annie Lowry. Robert Morris migrated from England to the American colonies as a teenager and established himself in the mercantile industry. During the Revolutionary War, his trading ships attacked British vessels and seized their cargo. After the conflict, the founding father became a millionaire, likely the country's first. He later invested in frontier real estate, a good bet made too soon. Morris went bankrupt spectacularly and spent the years 1798 and 1801 incarcerated in a Philadelphia debtor's prison. 5 decades later, John D. Rockefeller took a $1,000 loan from his grifter father and used it to buy an equity stake in an agricultural trading firm. He made a fortune selling food and dry goods to the Union Army during the Civil War and pushed his gains into an oil refining business. By the 1910s, the Standard Oil baron had become the country's first billionaire. Last month, Elon Musk became the country's first trillionaire when his rocket, satellite, and telecommunications company, SpaceX, went public. Not just that, he became the richest person in human history, surpassing Rockefeller, Cosimo de' Medici, and the 13th century Emperor Mansa Musa. The moment feels unsurprising, perhaps inevitable. It took 100 years to go from the era of the millionaire to the era of the billionaire, and another 100 years for us to enter the era of the trillionaire. If Musk hadn't gotten there, someone else would have, thanks to the magic of compound interest, if nothing else. 20 individuals or families are worth more than $100 billion today, according to Forbes magazine. Another 3,408 are worth more than $1 billion. Still, Musk becoming a trillionaire is not a product of a stable, long-standing trend, so much as it is the product of a radical recent one in which the country's capital class has pulled away from everyone else. The number of American billionaires has nearly doubled in a decade. The net worth of the country's richest person has increased tenfold after accounting for inflation. And the average family's holdings? They have grown more than a more moderate 40%. Wealth inequality is at a record high, higher than it was when protesters with "We are the 99% banners were taking to the streets and the president was referring to inequality as, quote, the defining challenge of our time. Inequality remains a defining challenge. It remains a problem America is failing to solve or even meaningfully address as the social and political consequences become more entrenched and more dire. The issue, to be clear, is not Musk himself. Say what you will about the guy, but he made his billions the way we would want any billionaire to make their billions, advancing the technological frontier, greening the planet, buying a socially cancerous micro-blogging site, and somehow making it even more malignant. I jest. He lost money on Twitter. The issue is the policy infrastructure that allows people like Musk to become not rich, not super rich, but plutocrat rich. That policy infrastructure includes, well, where to start? The preferential treatment of investment income versus labor income, low taxes on business profits, arcane provisions that allow companies to paper over their net incomes, right-to-work laws, the allowance of non-compete clauses, the carried interest loophole, setting the federal minimum wage below the poverty line, the permissibility of debt loading and asset stripping by private equity firms, the creation of pass-throughs, which allow business owner operators, to shield their earnings from taxation, minimal levies on estates and gifts, weak antitrust enforcement. As globalization and technological change have amplified market inequality, Washington has not only kept these policies in place, but rejiggered them to benefit the rich even more. The top marginal individual income tax rate is a few percentage points lower than it was a quarter century ago, and less than half as high as it was in the 1940s and 50s. The top corporate rate is 14 percentage points lower than it was from 1993 until 2017. The amount you can leave your heirs tax-free currently sits at $15 million. When George W. Bush took office, it was $675,000. The United States does less to tamp down on inequality now than it did 15 or 50 years ago. It does less to hold down inequality than nearly any other high-income nation does. As a result, the richest are becoming far, far richer than the rich. The rich are getting much richer than the middle class. The not rich are getting nowhere. From from 1989 to 2022, the amount of wealth a person needed to join the 1% climbed by $8.4 million, whereas the threshold to hit the median rose by $83,000. The share of assets owned by the top 0.1% climbed from 8.6% to 14.4%. The share of assets owned by the bottom 50% declined. In 2025 alone, the net worth of the country's billionaires increased by 22%, from $6.7 trillion to $8.2 trillion. Today, Musk is worth roughly 30% more than the country's 400 richest Americans were worth in 1989, combined. This concentration of capital is anathema to a thriving democracy. If money is power, Musk is now 5,208,333 times as powerful as the average American household. And he has used that power to deprive children in foreign countries of life-saving medication and scientific laboratories of much-needed financing. In general, hyper-wealth gives the hyper-wealthy outside sway over the country's laws, regulations, elections, tax code, and courts, perverting policy outcomes, destroying social trust, destabilizing the polity's sense of itself, increasing polarization, and ultimately destabilizing the political system, too. The more unequal income distribution is in a democracy, the more at risk it is of electing a power-aggrandizing and norm-shredding head of government, the political scientists Eli Rao and Susan Stokes have found. And inequality isn't great for the economy, either. It erodes human capital. It slows growth. The good news is that policy can undo what policy has done, helping the many rather than the few. The bad news is that people like Musk will be standing in the way. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.